Well, birds are a big part of the Wisconsin landscape, and conservation efforts are always underway. And we're going to be getting an update about the second Wisconsin Bird Atlas survey from our guest, Nick Edich, back with us. He's a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR and is the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas 2 coordinator. So have you volunteered to be a part of this one or maybe the previous survey? I hope you'll join in. What questions you have about it? You can reach us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Nick Edich, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So for those who don't know, what is the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas? We got one and two.
Yeah, so this was a big project to examine the distribution and abundance of all the birds that nest in Wisconsin. And so it was a massive citizen science project. We had over 3,500 surveyors, and we basically gridded out the whole state and sent people into over 1,200 priority blocks, which were 3 by 3 mile blocks. And we sent them out to go look for all the nesting birds they could find and collect all that data. The data was collected through eBird, which is the popular online reporting program that lets you put your sightings in there. And we wound up with over 2.8 million records of about 250 species that nest in the state. And so the fieldwork happened between 2015 and 2019 for this most recent atlas, which we can directly compare to the first atlas, which was done in the late 90s. And the main goal of this is basically assessing the status of all these species in the state. Are they holding steady? Are they increasing? Are they decreasing? And birds are a really good organism to use to look at the environment. They're fairly easy to survey. And if we know that a bird was common in the 1990s is now rare, that, you know, we can tell something has to be changing.
So, and you've been working on this project, as you say, since 2015. Why does putting something like this, well, first place, why do it? And then why does, it takes a long time, years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 2.8 million records came into the system, and those have to be checked by, you know, date and time of year and breeding code. And so, like I said, like the primary thing that we get out of this is really a comparison of species status. And because we are using the same methods as we were 20 years ago, you can really look at that and say, yeah, we have a pretty fair comparison to see what is happening with these different species. And it ends up being kind of a mixed bag with, you know, some declining and some increasing and many kind of staying the same. But you know, as far as bird monitoring goes, there's the Federal Breeding Bird Survey, which uses roadside routes, and then there's eBird, which uses incidental observations. And so you get really good information from popular birding spots and places that people live. But when you do the atlas, you also get people way out in the boonies. And so the whole state gets covered, and you start to fill in some of these data gaps.
And that's kind of the difference, I guess, between what you, the reason maybe you call it an atlas rather than a survey.
Yeah, no, I mean, it really is pretty comprehensive, and we probably sent some people out to areas that won't get looked at for another 20 years, which really fills in some good gaps for some of the more uncommon species especially.
Who can use the information found in the Breeding Bird Atlas?
So right now, we just finished vetting our 2.8 million records, and you can go online. The address is ebird.org/atlas WI. And if you go on there, you can pull up any species and see a map of where it bred in the state. And you can also look at things by atlas block and get a list of all the birds that nested near you. And we are in the midst of turning this into a final book, probably still a year or two out. But that'll have all sorts of additional maps and results. And so there'll be a page for each species where you'll be able to see its range and the change in the last 20 years. For many of the species, we have abundance maps showing where they're more or less abundant in the state. And things like breeding phenology, like time of year that they're nesting. So you've got great horned owls starting nesting in January or even December, in contrast to things like cedar waxwings, which might not get started till June. And then, you know, we're just starting to launch into this book writing process, really. And, you know, hopefully the advantage of doing it in the book also is some big picture synthesis and some big picture analysis. You know, what does all this mean for all of the state's birds? And, you know, the DNR internally has been using all this data to help us set our conservation priorities. Which species do we really need to be focusing on?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But anybody go online and look at that site?
Yes. Yep. So it's ebird.org/AtlasWI, and that has all the proof data from Atlas 2 and Atlas 1. So you can pull up any species you're interested in and kind of see where they are in summer.
I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have questions for Nick, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And let's talk about some of the maybe surprising or unusual findings to begin with. Excuse me, the first ever glossy ibis bred in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that one was a real surprise. So the glossy ibis is a wading bird, kind of like a small heron with a curved bill. And they pretty much breed on the Atlantic coast. And so it's not all that weird to have a couple turn up at like a big marsh, like Horicon Marsh. But they had never bred. But during the Atlas, people kept seeing two of them. And then later in the season, they saw those two with babies. So that was one that wasn't on our radar at all.
And they usually breed on the Atlantic coast, you said?
Yeah. So they're a marsh bird. So they like big marshes. And they found themselves in Horicon Marsh. And they said, this looks pretty good.
Oh, so it's sort of similar to what they might have found over on the Atlantic coast.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Atlases and eBird and other ways to track bird movements. It's, you know, people kind of think of these as static, but they're certainly not, depending on what the environment's like, you know, and what bird populations are like. You know, I don't foresee glossy ibis in particular making a big run into the state, but but there are bird ranges that shift over time.
Nancy in Mazamani has a question. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I'm wondering about those pink flamingos, if they've been sighted again.
The pink flamingos. Yeah.
No, this was the talk of the bird world here for the last couple weeks. So for people that hadn't heard, kind of straining belief, there were five flamingos there on the beach at Port Washington that a lot of people saw, and then they took off, and somebody had them north of the Dells in a marsh of the Wisconsin River, and then they finally settled in Lake Peatonwell in Adams County, where they were there for a couple weeks, and people could see them from some distance in a scope, and some people kayaked out there to get closer to them. To my knowledge, nobody knows where they currently are. this is part of kind of a never before seen movement of flamingos into the eastern U.S. So in a typical year, maybe there's a couple flamingos in Florida, but there's no place in the U.S. where there's a whole bunch of them. But that latest hurricane apparently formed like right across the Yucatan and dragged a whole bunch of them up, and so there were Ohio, Pennsylvania, like all these states, people like stumble onto flamingos. So it was quite the spectacle. And I don't think anybody really knows what's going to happen next with these birds. Hopefully they find their way back to a coast or something that's a little more suitable. But they did live in Wisconsin fairly happily for a couple of weeks, so they must have been finding something to eat.
I'm hoping someday to find to see a scarlet ibis here. I spent time in Trinidad. At the University of the West Indies, and one of the fun things for me was to go to the swamp, the Kearney Wildlife Sanctuary, and see the scarlet ibis, which is indeed a scarlet and bright bird.
Yeah, cool.
Oh, man. Nancy, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. What about you? Join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. Our guest today, Nick Anich, a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR, and he's the person kind of in charge of the survey that we're talking about today in the Atlas, the Breeding Bird Atlas. Mark in Arlington, I hope you can hang on. We are going to take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Nick Anich. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. The first Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas was conducted between 1995 and 2000. Field observers documented 235 breeding bird species in the state. Today we hear about the work being done to put out the second survey with our guest, Nick Anich. He's a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR and is the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas 2 coordinator. Questions or comments for him, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And now let's go to Mark in Arlington, who's been waiting a bit. Mark, thank you for waiting.
Oh, thanks. Hi, Larry and Nick. I was just going to say I want to thank Nick and Ryan for all that they did. This was an immense project, and everybody was impressed with the how the project went and all the data that was compiled. And I was going to say, we're using the data and connect with formerly Madison Audubon Society, now called Badger Land Bird Alliance. And we frequently get calls about what's nesting in the state and that, and we use it in some of our write-ups that we're doing on birds too. So it's easy to access the data. We really appreciate it. We also use it when we're writing for grants. But the question I've got for Nick is, a lot of us with not the best hearing or people that don't have the best sound recognition of birds now are really benefiting from Merlin sound. And in the future, I assume that's going to be a big player in the third Breeding Bird Atlas. But do you have any comments on how that'll, if you had that in the second Breeding Bird Atlas, would that increase the amount of confirmations or just IDs, knowing that you can hear the birds out there? Thanks.
Yeah, I'm Nick.
Well, thank Mark for your words of support. So he's referring to this Merlin app, which is an app you can get on your phone made by the Cornell Lab. And it can, one thing it can do is you can feed it a picture and it can look at it and give you a list of likely matches. Even slightly more amazingly is you can turn it on and it's like listening for all the birds that are calling. And if you give it your location and it's kind of using the probability of the birds in your location at that time of year, it does a pretty good job. It's not entirely infallible. Maybe it's 80 or 90% accurate, depending exactly what you're using it for. I think apps like Merlin really have their place. Like it is quite an amazing tool. If you're learning your birds, it can give you a hint to what's around and you can go look for it. I've played around with it a little bit. It doesn't seem to do quite a good his job as an actual person. I think people can hear a little bit farther than something like that can. But this is one of the things that people are moving towards in ornithology, is these automated recorders that you put out in the woods and you can let it run forever. And the technology, I think, is part of the way there on then having to process that information. Because I've seen some studies where somebody sits there and then listens to the tape and writes down everything they hear. There are a few automated tools people are working on to be able to, you know, get the data off of those recorders. So, I mean, for some species, that might be the ticket if you've got something that's really hard to detect, and then you can put your recorder out there and then bring it back and run through the data and it flags when that bird calls. But yeah, I mean, that's the kind of technology we'll probably be looking at potentially doing in Atlas 3. I know a lot of the Canadian atlases, particularly when they've got like large expanses where nobody lives and, you know, they canoe by and drop out an automated recorder and come pick it up later to see what was there.
Mm, interesting. In terms of volunteering, Matt in Madison emailed us. They housed a young researcher gathering data for the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. They worked really hard in often harsh condition, think mosquitoes, ticks, and black flies, and long, strange hours. So Matt says, many thanks to all who surveyed. It was a ton of often thankless work that will benefit all of us.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, the bird nesting season in Wisconsin is pretty short. The period the birds are singing most is probably from the end of May to early July. And so we did have some hired technicians, and they were working their butts off, getting up early and trying to make the most of those prime season days when the birds are most detectable out there.
Kristen in Wausau, we go to you now. Hi, Kristen.
Hello there. I just wanted to ask a question, and I've heard it proposed by another caller on a different show recently, but I don't think that they really explained it very well. My question is about the bluebirds this year, if there was something unusual about them. I have several houses in my yard, and I always have bluebirds nest there. This year in the spring, they came through, and they didn't stay, and so it was really unusual. And I had some other birds that I hadn't had before that nested in the yard. And not this week, but the week prior and the one before that, I had probably a dozen male bluebirds and females that were just crazy in my yard around those houses, like they found a gold mine. But I'm thinking that they're migrating south, and maybe they're just making a note that they missed it this year on their way up, or, you know, their GPS was off. It was just really a strange year. And then to have them just all sitting on my railing and just a cacophony of bluebirds was really strange after not seeing them all summer long. So I just wondered if there was something going up with them.
Oh, thanks, Chris. That's a great story. Nick?
That does sound like a migrant flock that you had recently. And, I mean, you might be right. They could be bookmarking your box, and they're going to come back next year and pop into it. When I think about bluebirds, there was maybe 2 years ago kind of a late spring storm in across eastern or southeastern United States that I think killed a lot of bluebirds and a lot of kind of early migrants. So they were starting to migrate up, and then the cold weather got them. And so I think bluebird populations have been a hair down ever since that event. You know, the thing that can always happen if you have a bluebird box in your yard is there's a couple other common birds that like to nest in them. And so, you know, whenever somebody puts a bluebird box up, you might get looked at by tree swallows, or might be looked at by house wrens. And so, you know, there's certainly a period where everybody's checking it out. And so you could have some bluebirds stop in migration, and they look at it and they say, well, we're not going to stop. And then, you know, the tree swallows end up getting it. The house wrens in particular are known for just taking over as many boxes as they can. The males like to come and build a bunch of nests for the female to choose from. So you can get your boxes all filled up by one house wren that later nests in a box somewhere else. So there's a little competition sometimes, when you've got a bluebird box, 1 year bluebirds will be in it, and another year maybe something else is happening.
Kristen, thank you so much for calling. Kathleen in Fifield emailed us. She's wondering about the drop in numbers of hermit and wood thrush. She's noted in the area south of Fifield. Have numbers of these thrush dropped across the state?
I think that hermit thrushes are suffering from the same event that I was just talking about with the bluebirds. I think that they got knocked back a little. Up here, we definitely noticed that. I'm up in northern Wisconsin. I think we've actually seen maybe an increase in wood thrushes. I think they might be shifting north a little bit, or maybe they're taking the opportunity if the wood, or if the hermit thrushes got shifted out. Our Atlas period tends to be, it ended in 2019. So I think that was before that cold event. So I don't think we have like really great data on whether that cold event, I think that cold event is mostly anecdotal as far as I know. But a lot of people have been noticing that a few species were affected, and hermit thrush, I think, is definitely one.
And as you look at the numbers, the drops, there have been bird nesters that have increased, and we're seeing more, but then there have also been those that have dropped, and the grassland birds and the boreal species were among those that have sort of declined a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. When you look at all the species that nest in the state, it ends up being a mixed bag, but there's a couple themes that come out. And so boreal species, which is to say birds that mostly nest in Canada associated with the boreal zone full of conifers and spruces, we are pretty much at the southern extent of their range in Wisconsin. And so these are birds like evening grosbeak and Canada jay, Connecticut warbler, boreal chickadee, blackback woodpecker. A lot of them are tied to kind of our best coniferous habitats we have. And as the climate gets less favorable for these species, you would expect that this southern range edge is going to be the spot that starts blinking out. And I think we're seeing that in a lot of these species tied to spruce habitats. And then similarly, grasslands, I think continent-wide are kind of a group of birds that aren't doing that well. People think there's a couple issues here. One of them is just conversion of grasslands to other types of crops. Early haying in particular, grassland birds come and they set up in a hay field, and then it gets cut before the young are able to fledge from the nest. And then another factor is just more intensive agriculture, loss of hedgerows. People are farming in ways that are a little cleaner, and it's a little less natural habitat for the birds. And so we've seen declines in western meadowlark, eastern meadowlark, bobwhite, upland sandpiper, sharp-tailed grouse. A lot of your grassland birds are struggling.
We have Dan in Independence with a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Good afternoon. We are building a cabin in Douglas County, in the sand county of Douglas County. In this, so it's pure sand all the way down. And when the foundation was dug, it sat as a big hole in the ground for quite a while. And one end of the foundation in the deep wall, because it's in a hillside, on one end of the deep side, there was swallows that built a nest in the excavation. And on the other side of the same foundation, there was a hole that I couldn't quite identify and never saw any birds going in and out. But after looking through different websites and seeing something, I saw two railroad tracks heading in on the bottom of the hole. And I decided that maybe it was the kingfishers that we see nearby, although I never saw the birds.
Yeah.
One morning, there was a 4-inch long northern pike on the bottom of the foundation hole, about 5 feet away from the hole. I picked it up and put it on a ledge that was right nearby. And sure enough, later that day, the baby northern was gone. So I'm sure the kingfishers were using it throughout the night to feed their babies. And later in the summer, there were babies in the bird in the trees nearby, and we never really saw any activity in or out of the nest.
Ah, interesting story.
Yeah, that's a cool story. I was gonna suggest kingfisher before you figured it out, but kingfishers and bank swallows are very much tied to sandbanks. And you know, when that was one thing we were mentioning to our atlasers when we send them out, is if you have a gravel pit or a sand pit in your block, or if you have a river with a deep bank, that's where they love to nest. And so in some cases their nests are a little ephemeral. If somebody has a big pile of sand and, you know, the bank swallows are in it one year, and then in the off season it gets moved to something else. But they both love sand to nest in, especially.
Terry in Fifield, on to you now. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I was wondering if you would know what happened with the whippoorwills. Back in the late 70s and 80s, we used to have a family that would literally get in our front yard, sit on our front porch, and just call.
Yeah,
I haven't heard one since.
Yeah, the latest, so whippoorwills are definitely declining, and they seem to be hanging on best in kind of the sandy country, or kind of if you have a lot of oaks, that seems to be the landscapes that they're hanging on the most in. The latest research I heard about suggested that they're hanging on in the landscapes where they have the most moths. So they're always out hunting at dusk and at night, and apparently moths are very important to them. So, you know, I don't know, there's been links with pesticides to insect declines and, you know, habitat conversion to other uses. And so this is, I think, an active area of study where people are trying to figure out exactly what is driving the decline in whippoorwills. But we're definitely seeing it.
Thanks, Terry, for calling. Another a new breeding bird in the state is the white-eyed vireo. That comes from, if I'm not mistaken, southern U.S. You wonder why it might have made its way to Wisconsin to breed.
Yeah, that's one. So we had a handful of birds that we newly confirmed as breeders that are coming from the south. And we also have a handful of species like Orchard Oriole and Carolina Wren that are really increasing their abundance in the state. And so, yeah, white-eyed vireo is kind of a thicket-loving. They like forests with thick shrub layers in them. But we're seeing them kind of come in across southern Wisconsin. They're not common yet, but we did manage to confirm a couple this time around.
I was kind of surprised to see that. I has always assumed that canvasbacks and buffleheads nested here in the state, but they've turned up as new nesters, so kind of surprised me.
Those are pretty rare sightings. I think the majority of them are nesting to the north and to the west of us. So we have more of the puddle ducks, the dabblers are nesting here. A lot of those diving ducks are nesting north of here.
Really interesting. Another one, king rail. For those who aren't familiar with it, what does a king rail look like?
Yeah, king rail is there's a group of birds called rails, and the sora is probably the one that people are most familiar with if they've ever seen a rail. But there's also a Virginia rail, and they're tiny little marsh birds that walk around in the cattails. The king rail in particular is one of the more secretive ones. And I mean, in all likelihood, there were probably a couple at Horicon Marsh in the first atlas, but because they're so secretive, I mean, you know, managing to find them out with their young or on a nest or something is just kind of a matter of luck. So I think this time around, somebody spotted a young bird, and we were able to definitely confirm them as nesting at Horicon. But there's probably a few out there lurking in the cattails. They're just not very easily seen.
Are there ways that some of these species, like the king rail or the white-eyed vireo, are there ways to encourage them to keep breeding in Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, it might be a species-by-species question. King rails, I think, like big cattail marshes. So I think Horicon is doing all the right things at the moment. White-eyed vireo, you know, like understory within forests. And so I think, you know, retaining decent sized tracts of forest in southern Wisconsin and maybe opening the canopy a bit or other ways to increase understory. But I think, I mean, with some of these, so some of these confirmed breeders, you know, like the bufflehead was probably just like a one-time thing.
Yeah.
But white-eyed vireos, I think, are probably moving in. And so presumably the climate is a little more favorable now than it was 20 years ago. And I would expect them to continue to gradually kind of shift north, you know, like we're on the trailing edge of all the boreal species that we're losing, but there's a whole another set of species where Wisconsin is on the northern range boundaries that we're probably going to be seeing increased populations in the years to come.
So in terms of the book itself, you got a little ways to go to get the book completely published, even though people can go in right now online and look at results.
Yep. So again, results are at eber.org/atlaswi. But we are eager to put all the pieces together and make a nice, basically like a coffee table size book with, you know, an account for every species and some big picture messages about birds in Wisconsin.
Are you going to get yourself involved in number three?
We'll see. I hope to get the book out before number three comes around.
Oh, man.
But yeah, I mean, we just had so much feedback from people who did the survey. And I think it, you know, it applies to birding in general. It's just a pleasant way to experience the outdoors. Like everybody who Atlas learned new things about nesting birds and the birds in their backyards that they had no idea about. You know, you poke around in some of the habitats near you and you're like, oh, I didn't know that species nested here. But
so it's ebird.org/atlas. Is it
.wi? Yeah. So our Atlas data is on ebird.org/atlaswi. But of course, ebird.org, so we're done collecting Atlas data, but eBird is still a great place to go to submit your bird sightings and view birds that are in your area. It's a very, very powerful, pretty easy to work website with a lot of, you know, birders can keep track of their sightings and see where people are seeing birds. And then scientists can grab the data for all sorts of things. So I highly recommend playing around with eBird if you're not familiar with it.
Nick, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you, Nick.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Nick Anich is a conservation biologist with the DNR and is the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas II coordinator. Great to have him with us, and we'll have him back. Wanted to have you join us on Thursday, October 26th. From 11 to noon for our next virtual book club meeting. This time, Ron Rindo is the author of the haunting book, Breathing Lake Superior, and there's still time to read it, so I hope you can join us. Again, that's Thursday, October 26th, right here on the Ideas Network, and the book is titled, it's a novel titled Breathing Lake Superior. Tomorrow we'll answer your questions about vehicle maintenance. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.